Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest this hour has spent many, many years on a journey into understanding Arab hearts and minds. It began as the Cold War ended, and just as Iraq's Saddam Hussein was emerging as the perceived winner of the devastating Iraq-Iran war that dominated the 1980s. The guest who is with us this hour, Shibli Talhami, is the author of The World Through Arab Eyes, Arab Public Opinion and the Reshaping of the Middle East. He focuses on the years 2003 to 2012 and information gathered from representative population samples in six Arab countries, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Morocco, Lebanon, Jordan, and the United Arab Emirates. And he looks at a number of issues. He looks at the values of people in a variety of regions and also looks at the notions of identity. When he started his work in 1990, he says most political scientists and foreign policy analysts discounted the importance of public opinion because the countries of the region were dominated by authoritarian rulers. But those opinions are no longer to be discounted, and they're really flushed out pretty thoroughly in our guest's book, The World Through Arab Eyes. If you would like to join our conversation with Professor Shibli Talhami, who is Anwar Sadat Professor for Peace and Development at the University of Maryland. He's also working with the Brookings Institution. He has served as an advisor to the U.S. mission to the U.N., as an advisor to former Congressman Lee Hamilton, a member of the U.S. delegation to the Trilateral U.S.-Israeli-Palestinian Anti-Incitement Committee. And he is with us this full hour. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and you can Twitter as well, and that's at K. Dunn Show. So, Professor Talhami, thank you very much for being with us. Hello.
Thank you for hosting me.
Yeah. What a big mission this was, and it's over such a long period of time. I'm wondering at what point you decided you would take this particular form of a journey into understanding Arab hearts and minds. What a goal that is, huh?
Well, it was really kind of almost accidental. And I say almost accidental because I'm a student of international relations. And like most of my generation, I really wasn't focused on public opinion. I was focused on hard power politics, state politics, government politics. And then when I took this trip at the end of the Cold War, really as an advisor to Congressman Lee Hamilton, who was at the time the chairman of the House Subcommittee on Europe and the Middle East, right at the tail end of, just as the Cold War ended, before Iraq invaded Kuwait, in the spring of 1990. And I went there essentially to understand how elites and governments understood the end of the Cold War and its consequences. And on that trip, I went to many countries in the region, but among those countries was Iraq. I was hosted by then Ambassador April Glaspie, who, as you recall, was her name was tied to the 1991 Iraq War.
Yes.
And she, while I was there, we learned that Palestinian PLO chairman Yasser Arafat was still in Baghdad at a time when he had no conversations with the U.S. He was prohibited with the U.S. executive branch, and therefore diplomats couldn't talk to him. And she suggested that I should meet with him, perhaps to give him a flavor of how Washington sees this issue and see if he might have some message to send to Washington. And when we met, of course, we talked about multiple issues, and there were more immediate issues that I wrote a report on. But one of the things that struck me as a political scientist at the time, how he kept focusing on Arab public opinion. And as I went through the region, there was no question a lot of anger with the U.S. at that time that I documented in my report. But It wasn't obvious that this would be relevant. We, after all, most of the rulers in the Arab world were authoritarian rulers, kings and sometimes presidents for life. And nobody really took seriously that public opinion matters. And so I kept scratching my head because a lot of the strategy that he thought he was pursuing was based on public opinion. He believed that Saddam Hussein was pursuing a strategy based on public opinion. And then the war happens in 1991.
Mm-hmm.
And we find a very complex reaction in the Arab world. On the one hand, you had the King of Jordan, King Hussein, who was a close ally of the U.S., so worried about his public opinion that he went against the U.S. by not supporting the American intervention and alienated his friends in the Gulf because he feared that his public opinion would come after him if he didn't. On the other hand, you had the Saudis who seemingly went against Arab public opinion by hosting American forces on their soil and seemingly got away with it.
Mm-hmm.
But getting away with it, if in the sense of surviving, that was true. But was that really the seeds of resentment that led to the emergence of Al-Qaeda down the road, which used that issue? And so that got me thinking very early on that perhaps we really don't understand the impact of public opinion, even on authoritarian rulers. And we may not even know what public opinion is, because when I was going around, I was talking to only a small group, sometimes journalists, academics, sometimes people in cafes, officials, but those were mostly elites. Do they really represent public opinion? And as I was writing on this in the mid-1990s, Al Jazeera comes into play with a transformation of the information in the region, which made public opinion even more important. And that's how I basically started thinking about designing a long-term project that tries to understand not only public opinion, but how the information revolution will impact it and how it will impact how people identify themselves. The identity of people in the Middle East, is that going to change as a consequence of the information revolution? Because in the end, public opinion is very much a reflection of people's identities.
Well, let's talk more about Al Jazeera. You write that the information revolution would affect not only Arab public opinion and the government's ability to control it, but potentially how Arabs identified themselves as Arabs and Muslims and Christians, as citizens of their countries and citizens of the world. So how did the information revolution, what did it do to all of that, to the identity?
Well, think about it this way. Besides, obviously, the information revolution did two things. One, it took away the monopoly of information from governments.
Mm-hmm.
Governments had every interest in telling their stories, their narrative as the main narrative, and getting loyalties from their citizens to their state and their rulers. The logic of Al Jazeera, when this information technology opened up, mainly when satellite television emerged and it became cheap enough that everyone pretty much can buy a satellite antenna and watch stations from outside their own boundaries, the whole logic of the market and the product that you put on TV changed. Because if you now are Al Jazeera or Al Arabiya or any of the pan-Arab transnational station, you're thinking, what is my market? You're no longer thinking my market is the Qatari or the Egyptian or the Jordanian. You're thinking my market is everyone in the Arab world who can speak Arabic and can watch me, 350 million people.
Mm.
And therefore, what am I going to put on TV to be able to attract the largest market? I'm going to put in a product that appeals to the commonalities among Arabs and Muslims, mostly because most Arabs and Muslims, obviously, they're also Christians and others. And so for that reason, what we have seen is the transnational media appealed to those commonalities. And Arabs were receptive because they already had transnational identities. But what we've seen over the entire decade is that the affinity with the state has declined, and the affinity with Muslim particularly, but also Arab, has expanded over the decade.
Mm-hmm.
And so in that sense, yes, it has had an impact on identity. That's a little more complex than just the media revolution. That's part of the story. The other part of the story actually is tied to a story that we hear today about the abdication of the Emir of Qatar, which is very fascinating in and of itself. He's young at 61. He abdicates and gives his rule to his son. One of the things that we've seen is that over the past decade, and really the past several decades, the longevity of Arab rulers has made it harder for people to differentiate between ruler and state. So if you are a Libyan, when you say, do you feel Libyan? Well, of course they do, but to say that also, or to feel that they identify with the state, was to say they identify Muammar Gaddafi, because Gaddafi was the only one they've ever known as ruler. And so in some ways, this absence of separation was also a part in the decline in the affinity with the state, especially given that those states weren't providing for the people.
I know that we tend to be somewhat chauvinistic in this country, but some of what you were getting at as well was what public opinion in this world thought of America and what it thought of potential American domination of the region, well, prior to 1990, of course, but after 1990 as well. What about that? Do we place too much importance on who we are in the world, or do we help shape public opinion, and do we help shape the events of the Arab Spring and other events because of who we are in the region?
Well, this is really an interesting story, actually. And obviously, you know, what's happening in the region at the core isn't directly tied to the U.S. The region has its own complexity, really dating back to the very inception of the modern political system after World War I with the disintegration of the Ottoman Empire, when the European powers imposed an order that was never optimal from the point of view of local identity. And to this day, we feel the strains of it, and it's reflected in Arab attitudes toward the rest of the world, toward the West, toward the dominant powers, and including toward the United States. But over the past decade, here is something that I think people haven't thought about enough. There's a debate ongoing. The Arab Spring emerges. People obviously want freedom. People obviously want democracy. People obviously are rejecting authoritarianism and dictatorship. And when we saw that, people said, well, there is no foreign policy slogans. They were there, but they weren't the dominant ones, whether it's in Egypt or Tunisia or elsewhere. Therefore, this wasn't at all about foreign policy or America or anybody else. And even to boot, some people who were part of the Bush administration, who were theoretically advocating democracy in the Middle East, said, "You see, it's the advocacy of democracy finally took hold in the people's aspiration." Well, if you look at that decade, that's not at all the way people, interpreted American foreign policy. And if anything, if American foreign policy added more impetus to the Arab anger with their own rulers, which was already there based on these rulers not performing well on the economy and jobs and education, etc., if there was an extra impetus, it was that these rulers were seen to be collaborators in an American project over a decade, that they felt it went against their aspirations. And that starts with really 1990, with the collapse of the Israeli-Palestinian negotiations and the advent of violence between Israelis and Palestinians. The Arabs always blamed the U.S. for Israeli actions, and then the Iraq War particularly. I mean, the Iraq War had huge damage on not only U.S. relations with the Arab world, obviously much of the world, but it brought home to people that their governments, meaning the Arab governments, were unable to stop the war that most people thought went against their vital interests. Mm-hmm. And even worse, they thought they were collaborating with the U.S. To make it happen.
We're going to welcome phone calls. Our guest this hour is the author of a fascinating book that's based on years and years of fascinating polling in many regions of the Arab world. The book is The World Through Arab Eyes, Arab Public Opinion and the Reshaping of the Middle East. Shibli Talhami is our guest. He is the Anwar Sadat Professor for Peace and Development at the University of Maryland. To you momentarily at 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show. And you can follow us on Twitter @KDunnShow. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. A reminder, because my chances to remind you are grown slim here, that our show is switching times on Monday of next week. We switch from this time period, where we've been for 8 years, to 1 o'clock in the afternoon. So please remember, follow us. It'll be the same show, just a different time. Talk of the Nation has its last broadcast this afternoon, a broadcast you may want to listen to. It's been a part of NPR for a long, long time, and we're going to miss it. So we're moving into that time period. And On Point from Boston, also a very good show, will move to the 9 to 11 time period. Here, we're on the air from Monday through Thursday. Our show Friday at 9, it will be the 45 North show with Ann Strangechamp. And in the afternoon from 1 to 3 on Friday, it will continue to be Science Friday. Go to WPR.org for more information about schedules. All right, two phone calls. 800-486-8655 is our number, and Scott in La Crosse is our first caller for you, Professor. Hi, Scott.
Hi, Kathleen. I told Rhonda it's not going to work. Move into the afternoon just to try to ditch me. I'm going to follow you, so sorry.
Thank you, Scott. Follow us.
But my question for the professor is as follows. I really know very little about that part of the world, except I've read some stuff, particularly about Iran. And what I read about Iran was that they have tried to control the media by controlling the sale of satellite dishes. And I guess if I were a dictator in that part of the world, that would be a pattern I'd try to follow. Do you know if it's still the case that Iran is still clamped down on satellite dishes, or are they getting Al Jazeera as well?
Well, I'm not sure actually about their own, television, what they're allowing on their own stations. But Iranians are able to get all kinds of stations, not just really through satellite and free air across, but also through the internet. I mean, don't forget that the internet has become such a huge story. And even though people try to block certain websites, it's very easy to get around it. And it happened. I was in China, and I needed to go to YouTube, and it was not allowed. And it was just very easy for me to do, and without doing all that much. But I really don't speak about Iran, because that's not Iran. Of course, is not an Arab country. I'm speaking about the Arab world, which constitutes 22 Arab countries, and it has a completely different media market, in large part because Arabs share a common language. Whatever differences they may have culturally or even politically, they have that shared language, and language is really essential for the media. And so for that reason, they've always, while governments were able to monopolize media to a large extent, never fully really. Even in 1950s and 60s, when TV wasn't dominant, radio was. The advent of radio, the Egyptians tried to put forth what was called Salt al-Arab, or the voice of the Arab people, that reached across the borders of the Arab world. Governments tried to jam it, and many of them succeeded up to a point. It was like a cat and mouse war. But in the end, nobody really could stop it. I think what we're upon an information revolution that's only going to expand. Anybody who thinks that they might be able to slow it down a little bit, but in the end, it's impossible to stop it.
Interesting. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Scott. Thanks for the call, as always. Our phone number, 800-486-8655. Let's talk about women for a moment and attitudes toward the role of women. You write about female activists having played a significant role in the Arab uprisings, taking to the streets, employing social media. And yet, it doesn't guarantee that this can be translated into long-term gains for women's rights. How did you poll on this issue, and were there great variations from region to region?
Yes, and as you know, historically, obviously, women activism in politics, once a crisis ends, doesn't necessarily translate into gaining rights. We've seen that even here during World War II or after revolutions in many countries, the Algerian Revolution. So it takes a lot more to achieve equality for women or a bigger role for women in society. And there's no escaping the fact that women are lagging behind in the Middle East as a region more than almost any other region around the world. And I think there's a lot of reasons for it, obviously, historically. But what I focused on in this particular work is not so much to look at the cultural and religious barriers which are there, or even the legal barriers which are there, and compare. I cover some of that, obviously, in terms of particularly since the Arab uprisings, and compare what's happening in Tunisia and what's happening in Egypt, where there's in some ways more problems for women and in some other ways perhaps more opportunities for women. But on the whole, it's probably more challenges for women, particularly in Egypt in the short term. But what I tried to address was based on an assumption, and I think a lot of literature supporting it, that in the end, yes, culture and religion matter, and certainly legal issues matter. The constitutional rights for women have to be protected because that frames the possibilities. But in the end, women empowerment, if we observe it across the board in multiple societies, is driven by one factor perhaps more than others, and that is economic empowerment, earning wages. And if you look at societies where women started demanding more rights and started acquiring more political rights, it was following the fact that they became more independent economically in earning wages. And so the focus was on whether there is really a cultural religious barrier for women to get to the workforce to start earning wages. So we've been polling on this for the whole decade to see whether there is a principled opposition to women working outside the home, to earn wages. And what we found is interesting, that in every single country, actually, we polled, including Saudi Arabia, majorities did not oppose women working outside the home in principle. That a majorities, in fact, supported women working outside the home, either always or when economically needed. But the largest plurality was supporting women working outside the home when economically needed. And so this seemed to support the thesis that much of the barrier in the Middle East to women employment has been the political economy of not creating enough incentive. Mm. And what we found, I was in Saudi Arabia in the fall. I went to a women's college. And it was interesting, by the way, even in places like Saudi Arabia, where women obviously lag behind on multiple scores, and certainly in participation in politics and in the workforce, they still have more women in colleges than men, as we do. But they are lagging in getting jobs. And I went to one of these women colleges, and I talked to the director, and she was saying that they make it a priority to try to give them skills to get jobs or become entrepreneurs. And she said, interestingly, that those women who actually have the potential to get jobs or have jobs are seen to be as more attractive marriage partners because of the increasing economic needs. So what I was trying to get at here is the data that we have seems to connect this issue. And I think that obviously political empowerment, economic empowerment go hand in hand. And clearly, if you look at the Arab uprisings, one of the driving forces is this sense of individual empowerment that comes with the information revolution. Mm-hmm. That's also touching women, including in places like Saudi Arabia.
Hmm. Well, let's spend a little bit of time talking about the initial uprisings, and I know that you were in Egypt, in Tahrir Square, and have a lot to say about the Egyptian revolution. You talk about the processes unleashed by the Tunisian and Egyptian revolutions, not episodic and likely to endure. And yet we have seen uprisings play themselves out differently in each country since those. Can you talk a little bit about the differences and also about the enduring nature of the revolutions?
That's really a central question because I think it goes to the core of what we should expect, what we, you know, what people have expected since the beginning of uprising. I know it was a romantic start, particularly the Tahrir Square start of people coming together peacefully, millions, chanting, you know, raise your head high, you're an Egyptian, people calling for dignity and freedom and democracy. Very, very infectious indeed, and it was mesmerizing, to be frank, when I was in the middle of it.
Mm-hmm.
But the reality of it is we have to understand what is the core issue here that explains the uprisings. The core issue is that we've had an incredible information revolution that's only expanding. I mean, that you have people who are empowered by virtue of this information revolution, not only in terms of their ability to get information outside of what government provide them, whether it's through transnational media or through the internet, and we've in the decade, for example, starting with the beginning of the decade, most people said they got the news from their own station, from their own country stations. By the end of the decade, the majority of people in every country said they got their news from outside their own boundaries, so they lost control. But there is something much more empowering in the interactive nature of the internet. And I think, well, we have to come to grips with it because it's at some level, it's a genuine empowerment of the individual in a way that is likely to stay with us and only expand. I compare it personally with the Industrial Revolution in Europe, not because it's equal, it's not. I mean, Industrial Revolution and the emerging empowerment of individual in that revolution was really based on economic empowerment that I think at the end is more powerful than the information revolution. But nonetheless, there is a dynamic here that is transformative. And so therefore, people are empowered. They're not going to go back. There's no going back. Mm-hmm. People will not accept, you know, dictators. But this doesn't tell you what the outcome will be. Mm-hmm. Because if you have empowered public, it doesn't mean that empowered public will dictate policy. It was never only about the public, even in democracies, even in our own democracy. There are institutions, there is distribution of economic power, of military power, there are forces that vie for control. It's that this empowerment of the public is a new dimension that doesn't end politics, it starts a new politics. And to complicate that even more, when you say public empowerment, the public isn't all of one mind. The public is divided. You mm-hmm. empower the left and the right. You empower the religious and the secular. You know, you empower the good guys and the bad guys. Everybody feels empowered, and everybody wants a piece of the pie. The more divided a society is, the more complicated the picture is. And we see that even in countries where there isn't a necessarily considerable ethnic diversity, like in Egypt, where the divide is far more ideological, political, particularly between the secular forces and the religious forces. But it's far more complicated when it does have ethnic diversity, like in places in Syria and elsewhere. And it's far more difficult when there's also a poverty added to it. In the rich states in the Gulf, which are not, by the way, immune to this, nonetheless, they have the capacity to buy themselves time by pouring a lot of money into the issue.
We are welcoming phone calls. Our guest is fascinating, isn't he? He's the author of The World Through Arab Eyes, Arab Public Opinion and the Reshaping of the Middle East. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. The email, if you'd like to use that, and a couple people have, is talk@WPR.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Let's go to an email from Jen in Heartland. Professor Talhami, the Middle East always wants our help, but frequently turns on the U.S. and blames it if things don't go exactly as they wanted. Is the bottom line, they want the U.S.'s money. The region seems very conspiratorial. It makes one think isolationism is the way to go.
Well, this is a fascinating question because when we say the Middle East, the writer is right in you know seeing that different reaction. We see that now in the mixed Arab attitudes about what the U.S. should do in the Arab world. Should it help Egypt, give it economic aid? Should it intervene militarily in Syria? What do people want the U.S. to do, and how do they evaluate the U.S.? So let me just give you two quick thoughts on this. The first thought is that overwhelmingly Arabs really don't trust American intentions. So even when the U.S. intervenes in American mind for humanitarian reasons or is helping economically, as it has with Egypt, for example, over the past, really since the Camp David Accords between Egypt and Israel in 1979, people see this as a strategic aid intended to advance American interests. In this case, when we ask them, and we do in the polling, what do you believe drives American policy in the Middle East? Overwhelmingly, roughly, 70 to 80% choose the two issues, controlling oil and helping Israel. Only less than 10% they say advocating democracy or human rights or give economic aid. So this mistrust of America's intentions means that you always have more opposition to American intervention than support. That, interestingly, is true even of Syria, where Arabs overwhelmingly want to see Assad overthrown. In my polling, over 80% of Arabs take the rebel side against Assad, particularly in the Sunni countries like Egypt and Saudi Arabia and Morocco and Jordan. But when you ask them, do they want the U.S. or somebody else to intervene? The overwhelming majority don't want to see a Western American intervention. Mm-hmm. So that's a complicated story. But one of the things we did find, and this is the second point I want to make, is that over the decade, the prism of attitudes toward the U.S. Is principally American policy toward the Arab-Israeli issue. Mm-hmm. We've documented this very thoroughly for the entire decade, where while there is mistrust, and obviously there was mistrust of America not only in the Middle East, but this added value of anger with America was much more connected to the Arab-Israeli conflict than anything else.
And let's talk a little bit more about that. What would have to change in terms of U.S.-Israeli relations to make the Arab population happier with happier?
Well, I think, obviously, the people who are realistic among the elites don't anticipate that American support to Israel will decline. What they think is that the U.S. is the only country in a position to bring about a fair peace between Israel and the Palestinians. And so we asked the question about what issue would improve your attitude toward the United States the most, the U.S. brokering fair Arab-Israeli peace based on the 1967 borders, at giving more economic aid to the region, advancing democracy in the region, and other issues that we put on the table. The number one answer is always advancing Arab-Israeli peace. That's one thing they want, and I think it's because this issue I think is very misunderstood here in America, and it's very misunderstood in many parts of the world. It's not that the Arab-Israeli issue is central to all of the things that are happening in the Middle East. It's not. It's not connected to the difficulties in the Sudan or the current difficulties directly in Syria or the complexity of things in Egypt. And Arabs in the morning don't wake up thinking Palestine or Israel or America. They think jobs and they think, education, just like anybody else in the world. But their attitudes toward the world are framed through the pain of this issue. And I think it is really for historical reasons that this issue has embodied all of the pain that Arabs feel in their relations with the rest of the world, particularly a sense of humiliation vis-a-vis the rest of the world. And it's like an open wound that flares up all too frequently and over which they feel they have no control. And it, in some ways, in at a time when they're seeking dignity, it's really, it represents dignity's antithesis to them. And the reason they link the U.S. to it is, think about it this way. It's in part, you can call it a success of American foreign policy. for much more than a decade, our politicians in Congress, our presidents, our vice presidents, have been saying, let there be no light between Israel and the U.S. Let there be no light between Israel and the U.S. Well, you know, guess what? It works. And so Arabs see no light between Israel and the U.S. The strategy has worked over the past decade, and therefore, mm-hmm. whenever they're angry with Israel, they're angry with the U.S.
Mm-hmm. Where did you grow up, Professor Tilhami?
I grew up in an Arab village near the city of Haifa in Israel itself.
Mm-hmm. And I would imagine that that is one of the things that has prompted your lifelong deep interest and work in this whole area. Obviously, you've got your own experiences, huh?
There's no question about that, although, you know, it's interesting how you end up getting drawn to that. I basically was more interested in the theories of international relations that I studied in my career, and then I ended up being drawn into this issue. But it is obviously, you know, because of my experiences and also my knowledge, because I'm,
yes.
Having a sense of what Arabs want and being fluent, obviously, in the language is my native language, but also being understanding what drives the Israelis and speaking Hebrew helped me also try to understand that aspect of it. And what I did actually in this book, in fact, when I wrote about the Arab-Israeli issue in particular, it tried to also poll among Israelis, and I did. A lot of polling among us are to compare how Arab views of this conflict are similar or different from those of Israelis. And we found, in some cases, mirror images, fascinating story that tells you about why peace is more difficult to attain.
More phone calls in a moment. The author of The World Through Arab Eyes, Arab Public Opinion and the Reshaping of the Middle East, Professor Shibli Tilhami, is our guest this hour of the program. He is the Anwar Sadat Professor for Peace and Development at the University of Maryland, also a non-resident senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. He's a member of the Council on Foreign Relations and has traveled well, many, many times, and was born in this part of the world, but has traveled extensively throughout the region looking at public opinion for a long time now. Two more phone calls momentarily. Again, the number 800-486-8655. Email talk@WPR.org. Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and Twitter is @KDunnShow. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Just a reminder, after 8 years in this time slot, we are moving times. Same show, different time, 1 o'clock to 3 in the afternoons, and that will start this coming Monday, the 1st of July. It is happening because Talk of the Nation has its last broadcast this afternoon. I hope you'll listen to that and thank them for the remarkable work they've done and important work giving voices to people all over the country and allowing them a chance to engage with the big issues and the big formulators of policy in this country. It's been well done for a long time. So I asked, actually, that we move into that time slot because it's a big void to fill, and because the nature of our show is similar to Talk of the Nation, so we're doing that. And On Point will be on at 9 o'clock in the morning, which will mean it's a live broadcast out of Boston. So Monday through Thursday, listen to us starting next Monday from 1 until 3. Same show, different time. There are other changes, of course, and additions of new shows, new afternoon programs, Central Time. So if you'd like to get more information about all the changes and some weekend additions to our lineup, go to WPR.org, WPR.org. Returning to phone calls now, Gary in Fitchburg is next. Hi, Gary.
Hi there. You know, one of the tragedies I see in the world is so much religious fervor. The Sunni versus the Shia reminds me somewhat of the Irish Protestant Catholics. Even though they had the same foundation, they were fighting one another. And so much war is created because of religious differences. And You know, I see this whole Sunni-Shia battle that's raging now and being ramped up. It almost makes me wonder if Israel doesn't see this as a good thing because their enemies are fighting each other. Would you ask the professor to comment, please?
Okay. Yes, you just did. Go ahead, Professor.
Well, I mean, for you know, what Israel really wants to see, historically, Israel obviously has not been unhappy to see divisions in the Arab world, particularly among states that were, you know, aiming to fight it. So the more division, the better. On the Shia-Sunni divide, though, I don't think it's really directly related to Israel. And it's not so much even to the religious differences. There are religious differences. There have been historical divide between Sunnis and Shia. There is sectarianism in the Middle East. But when you look at it, particularly in Iraq and in Lebanon, and they have coexisted and lived amicably despite those differences, in many cases marrying each other and their neighbors and cousins and uncles. And so it's much bigger than that. And it's usually strategic pictures that are exploited directly and in a way that fuels the sectarianism. We've seen that, you know, for example, in the fight in Syria, where the Syrian regime may have one aim, where Iran is intervening for strategic purposes, Saudi Arabia is countering it for strategic purposes. You have those two biggies essentially engage in a strategic conflict that ultimately draws on their supporters that typically come from particular communities. But one of the interesting things prior to the Syrian conflict, Syria may be changing situation a little bit in making sectarianism a little bit more prevalent, maybe even much more prevalent. But if you look back in just a couple of years ago in all of the polling, including really 2012, just a year ago in Egypt, when I ask people to make their judgment about rulers in the world or about their priorities or their fears, they don't break down always along Sunni-Shia divide. In particular, for example, in 2006-2007, I asked this question in all the countries where I poll, including Egypt and Saudi Arabia, countries that are mostly Sunni. Name the leaders that you admire most in the world outside your own country. And the one who was identified the most was Hassan Nasrallah, a Shia leader of Hezbollah, who's now embroiled in Syria. They probably wouldn't say that now, or many of them wouldn't anyway. But they said that because their sense of what was good was still seen through the prism of the Israel-Palestine question. And so for that reason, even their attitudes toward Iran, when you ask Egyptians and Saudis and Moroccans, name the two countries that are most threatening to you, you know, 70 to 80% say first Israel and then the U.S., and less than 20% say Iran, which is a Shia country. So it hasn't, while it's important, it hasn't been necessarily the prism through which Arabs see the world. But it has been more so since the Syrian crisis, in large part because it has strategic consequences for countries that happen to be Sunni and Shia, and particularly Saudi Arabia and Iran.
Hmm. Anything else, Gary?
Yes, I think if in fact if this conflict, Sunni-Shia conflict, expands in an ugly way, it really will tear much of the Middle East apart. And particularly, I mean, there are countries, particularly North Africa, where there aren't that many Shia, including Egypt. But even Egypt didn't escape it. There was a horrific and tragic episode just in the past week where a Shia house was attacked by militant Sunnis. It's hard to know who they are. It was obviously condemned by most people in Egypt. But nonetheless, in a country where the Shia are less than 1% of the population, you found a little bit of that take place. And that is scary to a lot of people. One reason why the new Emir of Qatar, Sheikh Tamim bin Khalifa Al Thani, who was just sworn in yesterday in his speech, when you listened to his speech, it's fascinating that the two issues that he decided to highlight on is to take on these divisions along religious lines and say this is not, it shouldn't be supported, and Qatar will not support it or tolerate it. And the second thing was to say that he, Qatar is committed to the issue of Palestine, again, you know, the prism of pain through which Arabs see the world.
Thanks, Gary, for the call. Here's an email from MJ. Professor Talhami, will you address generational differences in Arab public opinion? My husband is a Syrian-American and a human rights organizer. He's noticed a marked difference in generational attitudes among this his human rights colleagues. For example, many of the older activists are staunchly Marxist in orientation. The younger activists are more eclectic in their worldview.
You know, it's interesting. Yes, there are obviously generational differences on some of the issues, particularly the behavioral issues. For example, when you ask people, what is your first source of news? Over the decade, television has been king. You know, 5 years ago, it was like over 90% of people say television. But what has happened, particularly over the past 5 years, is a huge increase in the number of young people who say the main source of news is the Internet. And so that tells you something about the diversity of issues. Another thing related to identity. When we, you know, one of the questions we ask people, we understand you all these things, Arab and Muslim and Egyptian or Jordanian and citizen of the world, what do you consider yourself first? Are you first Muslim or Arab or Egyptian, let's say, or citizen of the world? The people who say citizens of the world are, of course, a minority, always a minority, by far the smallest group. But among the young, it's more significant. So we find that. But interestingly, on foreign policy specifically, we don't see major differences, including on attitudes toward the United States.
That's interesting. Finally, I want to ask you, because I always wonder why there isn't more going on in Saudi Arabia. When you look at the part of the book, Arab Public Opinion and the Reshaping of the Middle East, one of the last chapters, you talk about no government in the Arab world fully immune to revolt, even including the oil-rich countries. Could there be, is it far-fetched to think that there could be any kind of revolt in Saudi Arabia? It does seem to be immune.
Well, you know, Egypt seemed immune until it happened to Mubarak. Look back and see, you know, what happened in Egypt. And Egypt, you know, wasn't exactly the most ruthless state under Mubarak. I mean, he was undoubtedly a dictator, but he was not a Gaddafi, and he was not an Assad, and he was not a Saddam Hussein. So really, people didn't expect it. They didn't see it coming, and it happened. So the fact that you don't expect it or it doesn't happen the same moment doesn't mean it's not going to happen. But I will say one thing about the Saudis. It's a very, you know, Prince Bandar of Saudi Arabia, currently their head of intelligence, who used to be the ambassador to Washington, used to say, don't underestimate our, meaning the royal family's, instinct for survival. We know what we have to do. And certainly they have poured a lot of resources into the security. They've been able to create mechanisms of supporting their system. They're spread out. While they have a major Shia minority, it's really limited to a particular region. In fact, if the Shia were to rise, it would probably rally the Sunnis behind the monarchy rather than the other way around. But the one thing they did right after the Arab uprising started, they were very nervous, like everybody else was. The king went on television and decreed to pour tens of billions of dollars into the public sector, into raising salaries, into increasing the security, into improving the situation on the ground. And they had the ability to do it. So yes, of course, you know, this could buy you time, but in and of itself, the empowerment that is driven by this information revolution, particularly among the young men and women, is with us to stay. And before long, they'll demand a voice.
Fascinating. Thank you. It's been a wonderful hour. So informative. And thanks for the book. Our guest, Professor Shibley Telhami. His book, which has just been published, is The World Through Arab Eyes. He is the Anwar Sadat Professor for Peace and Development at the University of Maryland. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this interesting hour. A reminder that starting Monday, we switch to the afternoons, 1 to 3. It'll be the same show, just a different time period, and we hope you will make the change with us. On Point will be during these hours starting Monday, so don't think we went away. We just went to a different time. Thanks for listening. Great conversations ahead.